Hemstock was about, but found no one there. He went back to the Owens's tomb, but found it also deserted. Neither his father nor Mistress Owens was anywhere to be seen. Panic started then, a low-level panic. It was the first time in his 10 years that Bod could remember feeling abandoned in the place he had always thought of as his home. He ran down the hill to the old chapel, where he waited for Silas. Silas did not come.
Perhaps I missed him,
thought Bod. But he did not believe this. He walked up the hill to the very top and looked out. The stars hung in the chilly sky, while the patterned lights of the city spread below him, street lights and car headlights, and things in motion. He walked slowly down from the hill until he reached the graveyard's main gates, and he stopped there. He could hear music. Bod had listened to all kinds of music, the sweet chimes of the ice cream van, the songs that played on workmen's radios, the tunes that Clarity Jake played the dead on his dusty fiddle. But he had never heard anything like this before. A series of deep swells, like the music at the beginning of something, a prelude, perhaps, or an overture. He slipped through the locked gates, walked down the hill, and into the old town. He passed the Lady Mayoress, standing on a corner, and as he watched, she reached out and pinned a little white flower to the lapel of a passing businessman.
"I don't make personal charitable donations. I leave that to the office."
"It's not for charity. It's a local tradition."
"Ah."
And he pushed his chest out, displaying the little white flower to the world, and walked off, proud as punch. A young woman pushing a baby buggy was the next to go past.
"What's it for?"
she asked, suspiciously, as the mayoress approached.
"One for you, one for the little one."
She pinned the flower to the young woman's winter coat. She stuck the flower for the baby to its coat with tape.
"But what's it for?"
"It's an old town thing. It's some sort of tradition."
Bod walked on. Everywhere he went, he saw people wearing the white flowers. On the other street corners, he passed the men who had been with the Lady Mayoress, each man with a basket, handing out the white flowers. Not everyone took a flower, but most people did. The music was still playing. Somewhere at the edge of perception, solemn and strange. Bod cocked his head to one side, trying to locate where it was coming from, without success. It was in the air and all around. It was playing in the flapping of flags and awnings, in the rumble of distant traffic, the click of heels on the dry paving stones. And there was an oddness, thought Bod, as he watched the people heading home. They were walking in time to the music. The man with the beard and the turban was almost out of flowers. Bod walked over to him.
"Excuse me."
The man started.
"I did not see you."
"Sorry. Can I have a flower as well?"
The man with the turban looked at Bod with suspicion.
"Do you live around here?"
"Oh, yes."
The man passed Bod a white flower. Bod took it, then said,
"Ow!"
as something stabbed into the base of his thumb.
"You pin it to your coat. Watch out for the pin."
A bead of crimson was coming up on Bod's thumb. He sucked at it while the man pinned the flower to Bod's sweater.
"I've never seen you around here."
"I live here, all right. What are the flowers for?"
"It was a tradition in the old town, before the city grew up around it. When the winter flowers bloom in the graveyard on the hill, they are cut and given out to everybody, man or woman, young or old, rich or poor.
The music was louder now. Bod wondered if he could hear it better because he was wearing the flower. He could make out a beat, like distant drums, and a skirling, hesitant melody that made him want to pick up his heels and march in time to the sound. Bod had never walked anywhere as a sightseer before. He had forgotten the prohibitions on leaving the graveyard, forgotten that tonight in the graveyard on the hill, the dead were no longer in their places. All that he thought of was the old town, and he trotted through it, down to the municipal gardens in front of the old town hall, which was now a museum and tourist information centre, the town hall itself having moved into much more imposing, if newer and duller, offices halfway across the city. There were already people around, wandering the municipal gardens, now in midwinter little more than a large grassy field, with here and there some steps, a shrub, a statue. Bod listened to the music entranced. There were people trickling into the square in ones and twos, in families, or alone. He had never seen so many living people at one time. There must have been hundreds of them, all of them breathing, each of them as alive as he was, each with a white flower.
Is this what living people do?
But he knew that it was not. That this, whatever it was special. The young woman he had seen earlier pushing a baby buggy stood beside him, holding her baby, swaying her head to the music.
How long does the music go on for?
But she said nothing, just swayed and smiled. Bod did not think she smiled much normally, and only when he was certain that she had not heard him, that he had faded, or was simply not someone she cared enough about to listen to, she said,
"Blimmin' heck! It's like Christmases."
She said it like a woman in a dream, as if she was seeing herself from the outside. In the same not-really-there tone of voice, she said,
"Puts me in mind of me grand-sister, Aunt Clara. The night before Christmas we'd go to her, after me gran passed away, and she'd play music on her old piano, and she'd sing sometimes, and we'd eat chocolates and nuts, and I can't remember any of the songs she sung. But that music, it's like all of them songs playing at once."
The baby seemed asleep, with its head on her shoulder, but even the baby was swaying its hands gently in time to the music. And then the music stopped, and there was silence in the square, a muffled silence, like the silence of falling snow, all noise swallowed by the night and the bodies in the square. No one stamping or shuffling, scarcely even breathing. A clock began to strike, somewhere close at hand, the chimes of midnight. And they came. They walked down the hill in a slow procession, all stepping gravely, all in time, filling the road five abreast. Bod knew them, or knew most of them. In the first row, he recognized Mother Slaughter and Josiah Worthington and the old Earl, who had been wounded in the Crusades and came home to die, and Dr. Trefusis, all of them looking solemn and important. There were gasps from the people in the square. Someone began to cry, saying,
"Lord, have mercy! It's a judgment on us! That's what it is!"
Most of the people simply stared, as unsurprised as they would have been if this had happened in a dream. The dead walked on, row on row, until they reached the square. Josiah Worthington walked up the steps until he reached Mrs. Carraway, the Lady Mayoress. He extended his arm and said, loud enough that the whole square could hear him,
"Gracious lady, this I pray, join me in the Macabre."
Mrs. Carraway hesitated. She glanced up at the man beside her for guidance. He wore a robe and pyjamas and slippers, and he had a white flower pinned to the lapel of his robe. He smiled and nodded to Mrs. Carraway.
"Of course."
She reached out a hand. As her fingers touched Josiah Worthington's, the music began once more. If the music Bod had heard until then was a prelude, it was a prelude no longer. This was the music they had all come to hear. A melody that plucked at their feet and fingers. They took hands, the living with the dead, and they began to dance. Bod saw Mother Slaughter dancing with the man in the turban, while the businessman was dancing with Louisa Bartleby. Mistress Owens smiled at Bod as she took the hand of the old newspaper seller, and Mr. Owens reached out and took the hand of a small girl, without condescension, and she took his hand, as if she had been waiting to dance with him her whole life. Then Bod stopped looking because someone's hand closed around his, and the dance began. Liza Hemstock grinned at him.
"This is fine,"
she said, as they began to tread the steps of the dance together. Then she sang, to the tune of the dance.
"Step and turn and walk and stay, now we dance the Macabre."
The music filled Bod's head and chest with a fierce joy, and his feet moved as if they knew the steps already, had known them forever. He danced with Liza Hemstock, and then, when that measure ended, he found his hand taken by Fortinbras Bartleby, and he danced with Fortinbras, stepping past lines of dancers, lines that parted as they came through. Bod saw Abanaza Bolger dancing with Miss Borrows, his old former teacher. He saw the living dancing with the dead. And the one-on-one dances became long lines of people, stepping together in unison, walking and kicking.
La 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 oomph! La 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 oomph!
A line dance that had been ancient 1,000 years before. Now he was in the line beside Liza Hemstock.
"Where does the music come from?"
She shrugged.
"Who's making all this happen?"
"It always happens. The living may not remember, but we always do."
And she broke off, excited.
"Look!"
Bot had never seen a real horse before, only in the pages of picture books. But the white horse that clopped down the street towards them was nothing like the horses he had imagined. It was bigger by far, with a long, serious face. There was a woman riding on the horse's bare back, wearing a long grey dress that hung and gleamed beneath the December moon like cobwebs in the dew. She reached the square, and the horse stopped, and the woman in grey slipped off it easily and stood on the earth, facing them all, the living and the dead of them. She curtsied, and, as one, they bowed or curtsied in return, and the dance began anew.
"Now the lady on the grey leads us in the Macabre,"
sang Liza Hemstock, before the whirl of the dance took her off and away from Bod. They stomped to the music, and stepped and spun and kicked, and the lady danced with them, stepping and spinning and kicking with enthusiasm. Even the white horse swayed its head and stepped and shifted to the music. The dance sped up, and the dancers with it. Bod was breathless, but he could not imagine the dance ever stopping. The Macabre, the dance of the living and the dead, the dance with death. Bod was smiling, and everyone was smiling. He caught sight of the lady in the grey dress from time to time as he spun and stumped his way across the municipal gardens.
Everyone, everyone is dancing.
He thought it, and as soon as he thought it, he realized that he was mistaken. In the shadows by the old town hall, a man was standing, dressed all in black. He was not dancing. He was watching them. Bod wondered if it was longing that he saw on Silas's face, or sorrow, or something else. But his guardian's face was unreadable. He called out,
"Silas!"
hoping to make his guardian come to them, to join the dance, to have the fun they were having. But when he heard his name, Silas stepped back into the shadows and was lost to sight.
Last dance?
And the music skirled up into something stately and slow and final. Each of the dancers took a partner, the living with the dead, each to each. Bod reached out his hand and found himself touching fingers with and gazing into the grey eyes of the lady in the cobweb dress. She smiled at him.
"Hello, Bod."
"Hello,"
he said as he danced with her.
"I don't know your name."
"Names aren't really important."
"I love your horse. He's so big. I never knew horses could be that big."
"He is gentle enough to bear the mightiest of you away on his broad back, and strong enough for the smallest of you as well."
"Can I ride him?"
"One day,"
she told him, and her cobweb skirts shimmered.
"One day. Everybody does."
"Promise?"
"I promise."
And with that, the dance was done. Bod bowed low to his dancing partner, and then, and only then, did he feel exhausted, feel as if he had been dancing for hour after hour. He could feel all his muscles aching and protesting. He was out of breath. A clock somewhere began to strike the hour, and Bod counted along with it. 12 chimes. He wondered if they had been dancing for 12 hours or 24, or for no time at all. He straightened up and looked around him. The dead had gone, and the lady on the grey. Only the living remained, and they were beginning to make their way home, leaving the town square sleepily, stiffly, like people who had awakened from a deep sleep, walking without truly waking. The town square was covered with tiny white flowers. It looked as if there had been a wedding. Bod woke the next afternoon in Mearins's tomb, feeling like he knew a huge secret, that he had done something important and was burning to talk about it. When Mistress Owens got up, Bod said,
"That was amazing last night."
"Oh, yes."
"We danced, all of us, down in the old town."
"Did we indeed? Dancing, is it? And you know you aren't allowed down into the town."
Bod knew better than even to try to talk to his mother when she was in this kind of mood. He slipped out of the tomb into the gathering dusk. He walked up the hill to the Black Obelisk and Josiah Worthington's stone, where there was a natural amphitheatre, and he could look out at the old town and at the lights of the city around it. Josiah Worthington was standing beside him.
"You began the dance with the mayor. You danced with her."
Josiah Worthington looked at him and said nothing.
"You did."
"The dead and the living do not mingle, boy. We are no longer part of their world. They are no part of ours. If it happened that we danced the dance macabre with them, the dance of death, then we would not speak of it.
and we certainly would not speak of it to the living.
But I'm one of you.
Not yet, boy. Not for a lifetime.
And Vod realized why he had danced as one of the living, and not as one of the crew that had walked down the hill.
I see. I think.
He went down the hill at a run, a 10-year-old boy in a hurry, going so fast he almost tripped over Digby Pool, 1785 to 1860, as I am, so shall you be. Righting himself by effort of will, and charged down to the old chapel, scared he would miss Silas, that his guardian would already be gone by the time Bod got there. Bod sat down on the bench. There was a movement beside him, although he heard nothing move.
Good evening, Bod.
You were there last night. Don't try and say you weren't there or something, because I know you were.
Yes.
I danced with her. With the lady on the white horse.
Did you?
You saw it. You watched us. The living and the dead. We were dancing. Why won't anyone talk about it?
Because there are mysteries. Because there are things that people are forbidden to speak about. Because there are things they do not remember.
But you're speaking about it right now. We're talking about the macabre.
I have not danced it.
You saw it, though.
I don't know what I saw.
I danced with the lady, Silas.
His guardian looked almost heartbroken then, and Bod found himself scared, like a child who has woken a sleeping panther. But all Silas said was,
"This conversation is at an end."
Bod might have said something. There were 100 things he wanted to say, unwise though it might have been to say them, when something distracted his attention, a rustling noise, soft and gentle, and a cold feather touch as something brushed his face. All thoughts of dancing were forgotten then, and his fear was replaced with delight and with awe. It was the third time in his life that he had seen it.
"Look, Silas, it's snowing,"
he said, joy filling his chest and his head, leaving no room for anything else.
"It's really snow."
Interlude. The Convocation. A small sign in the hotel lobby announced that the Washington Room was taken that night by a private function, although there was no information as to what kind of function this might be. Truthfully, if you were to look at the inhabitants of the Washington Room that night, you would have no clearer idea of what was happening. Although a rapid glance would tell you that there were no women in there. They were all men. That much was clear. And they sat at round dinner tables, and they were finishing their dessert. There were about 100 of them, all in sober black suits. But the suits were all they had in common. They had white hair, or dark hair, or fair hair, or red hair, or no hair at all. They had friendly faces, or unfriendly, helpful or sullen, open or secretive, brutish or sensitive. The majority of them were pink-skinned, but there were black-skinned men and brown-skinned. They were European, African, Indian, Chinese, South American, Filipino, American. They all spoke English when they talked to each other or to the waiters, but the accents were as diverse as the gentlemen. They came from all across Europe and from all over the world. The men in black suits sat around their tables, while up on a platform, one of their number, a wide, cheery man dressed in a morning suit, as if he had just come from a wedding, was announcing good deeds done. Children from poor places have been taken on exotic holidays. A bus had been bought to take people who needed it on excursions. The man Jack sat at the front center table, beside a dapper man with silver-white hair. They were waiting for coffee.
Time's a-ticking, and we're none of us getting any younger.
I've been thinking, that business in San Francisco, 4 years ago,
was unfortunate. But like the flowers that bloom in the spring, Trella, absolutely nothing to do with the case. You failed, Jack. You were meant to take care of them all. That included the baby. Especially the baby. Nearly only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
A waiter in a white jacket poured coffee for each of the men at the table. A small man with a pencil-thin black moustache. A tall blonde man, good-looking enough to be a film star or a model, and a dark-skinned man with a huge head who glared out at the world like an angry bull. These men were making a point of not listening to Jack's conversation and instead were paying attention to the speaker, even clapping from time to time. The silver-haired man added several heaped spoonfuls of sugar to his coffee. Stirred it, briskly.
10 years. Time and tide wait for no man. The babe will soon be grown. And then what?
I still have time, Mr. Dandy.
But the silver-haired man cut him off, stabbing a large pink finger in his direction.
You had time. Now you just have a deadline. Now you've got to get smart. We can't cut you any slack. Not any more. Sick of waiting, we are. Every man Jack of us.
The man Jack nodded curtly.
I have leads to follow.
The silver-haired man slurped his black coffee.
Really?
Really? And I repeat, I think it's connected with the trouble we had in San Francisco.
You've discussed this with the secretary.
Mr. Dandy indicated the man at the podium, who was, at that moment, telling them about hospital equipment. Bought in the previous year from their generosity.
Not one, not two, but three kidney machines.
The men in the room applauded themselves and their generosity politely. The man Jack nodded.
I've mentioned it.
And?
He's not interested. He just wants results. He wants me to finish the business I started.
We all do, Sunshine. The boy's still alive. And time is no longer our friend.
The other men at the table, who had pretended not to be listening, grunted and nodded their agreement.
Like I say, time's a-ticking.
Chapter 6. Nobody Owens' School Days. rain in the graveyard, and the world puddled into blurred reflections. Bord sat, concealed from anyone living or dead, who might come looking for him, under the arch that separated the Egyptian walk and the northwestern wilderness beyond it from the rest of the graveyard. And he read his book.
"Dammy!"
came a shout from down the path.
"Dammy, sir, and blast your eyes. When I catch you and find you, I shall make you rue the day you were born."
Bod sighed, and he lowered the book, and leaned out enough to see Thackeray Porringer, 1720 to 1734, son of the above, come stamping up the slippery path. Thackeray was a big boy. He had been 14 when he died, following his initiation as an apprentice to a master house painter. He had been given 8 copper pennies and told not to come back without a half a gallon of red and white striped paint for painting barber's poles. Thackeray had spent 5 hours being sent all over the town one slushy January morning, being laughed at in each establishment he visited, and then sent on to the next. When he realized he had been made a fool of, he had taken an angry case of apoplexy, which carried him off within the week, and he died glaring furiously at the other apprentices, and even at Mr. Horobin, the master painter, who had undergone so much worse back when he was apprenticed that he could scarcely see what all the fuss was about. So Thackeray Porringer had died in a fury, clutching his copy of Robinson Crusoe, which was, apart from a silver sixpence with the edges clipped, and the clothes he had formerly been standing up in, all that he owned. And, at his mother's request, he was buried with his book. Death had not improved Thackeray Porringer's temper. And now he was shouting.
"I know you're here somewhere. Come out and take your punishment, you thief!"
Bod closed the book.
"I'm not a thief, Thackeray. I'm only borrowing it. I promise I'll give the book back when I've finished it."
Thackeray looked up, saw Bod nestled behind the statue of Osiris.
"I told you not to."
Bod sighed.
"But there are so few books here. It's just up to a good bit anyway. He's found a footprint. It's not his. That means someone else is on the island."
"It's my book. Give it back."
Bod was ready to argue, or simply to negotiate, but he saw the hurt look on Thackeray's face, and he relented. Bod clambered down the side of the arch, jumped the last few feet. He held out the book.
"Here."
Thackeray took it, gracelessly, and glared.
"I could read it to you. I could do that."
"You could go and boil your fat head."
And he swung a punch at Bod's ear. It connected, and it stung, although, judging from the look on Thackeray Porringer's face, Bod realized it must have hurt his fist as much as it hurt Bod. The bigger boy stumped off down the path, and Bod watched him go, ear hurting, eyes stinging. Then he walked through the rain, back down the treacherous ivy-covered path. At one point, he slipped and scraped his knee, tearing his jeans. There was a willow grove beside the wall, and Bod almost ran into Miss Euphemia Horsfall and Tom Sands, who had been stepping out together for many years. Tom had been buried so long ago that his stone was just a weathered rock, and he had lived and died during the Hundred Years' War with France, while Miss Euphemia, 1861 to 1883, "she sleeps, aye, yet she sleeps with angels," had been buried in Victorian times, after the graveyard had been expanded and extended and became, for some 50 years, a successful commercial enterprise, and she had a whole tomb to herself behind a black door in the Willow Walk. But the couple seemed to have no troubles with the difference in their historical periods.
You should slow down, young Bod. You'll do yourself an injury.
You already did. Oh, dear Bod, I have no doubt that your mother will have words with you about that. It's not as if we can easily repair those pantaloons.
Sorry.
And your guardian was looking for you.
Bod looked up at the grey sky.
But it's still daylight.
He's up betimes.
A word which Bod knew meant early.
And said to tell you he wanted you, if we saw you.
Bod nodded.
There's ripe hazelnuts in the thicket just beyond the Little John's monument,
said Tom with a smile, as if softening a blow.
Thank you.
He ran on, pell-mell, through the rain and down the winding path, into the lower slopes of the graveyard, running until he reached the old chapel. The chapel door was open, and Silas, who had love for neither the rain nor for the remnants of the daylight, was standing inside, in the shadows.
I heard you were looking for me.
Yes. It appears you've torn your trousers.
I was running. I got into a bit of a fight with Thackeray Porringer. I wanted to read Robinson Crusoe. It's a book about a man on a boat. That's a thing that goes in the sea, which is water, like an enormous puddle, and how the ship is wrecked on an island, which is a place on the sea where you can stand, and...
It has been 11 years, Bod. 11 years that you have been with us.
Right. If you say so.
Silas looked down at his charge. The boy was lean, and his mouse-coloured hair had darkened slightly with age. Inside the old chapel, it was all shadows.
I think it is time to talk about where you came from.
Bod breathed in deeply.
It doesn't have to be now. Not if you don't want to.
He said it as easily as he could, but his heart was thudding in his chest. Silence. Only the patter of the rain and the wash of the water from the drainpipes. A silence that stretched until Bod thought that he would break.
You know you're different. That you are alive. That we took you in, they took you in here, and that I agreed to be your guardian.
Bod said nothing. Silas continued, in his voice like velvet.
You had parents, an older sister. They were killed. I believe that you were to have been killed as well, and that you were not was due to chance and the intervention of the Owenses.
And you,
said Bod, who had had that night described to him over the years by many people, some of whom had even been there. It had been a big night in the graveyard.
Out there, the man who killed your family is, I believe, still looking for you. Still intends to kill you.
Bod shrugged.
So? It's only death. I mean, all of my best friends are dead.
Yes, they are. And they are, for the most part, done with the world. You are not. You're alive, Bod. That means you have infinite potential. You can do anything, make anything, dream anything. If you change the world will change. Potential. Once you're dead, it's gone. Over. You've made what you've made, dreamed your dream, written your name. You may be buried here, you may even walk. But that potential is finished.
Bod thought about this. It seemed almost true, although he could think of exceptions. His parents adopting him, for example. That the dead and the living were different. He knew that, even if his sympathies were with the dead.
What about you?
What about me?
Well, you aren't alive, and you go around and do things.
I am precisely what I am, and nothing more. I am, as you say, not alive. But if I am ended, I shall simply cease to be. My kind are, or we are not, if you see what I mean.
Not really.
Silas sighed. The rain was done, and the cloudy gloaming had become true twilight.
Bod, there are many reasons why it is important that we keep you safe.
The person who hurt my family, the one who wants to kill me, you're certain that he's still out there?
It was something he had been thinking about for a while now, and he knew what he wanted.
Yes. He's still out there.
Then,
said Bod, and said the unsayable.
I want to go to school.
Silas was imperturbable. The world could have ended, and he would not have turned a hair. But now his mouth opened, and his brow furrowed.
What?
I've learned a lot in this graveyard. I can fade, and I can haunt. I can open a ghoul gate, and I know the constellations. But there's a world out there, with the sea in it, and islands, and shipwrecks, and pigs. I mean, it's filled with things I don't know. And the teachers here have taught me lots of things. But I need more, if I'm going to survive out there one day.
Silas seemed unimpressed.
Out of the question. Here we can keep you safe. How could we keep you safe out there? Outside anything could happen.
Yes, that's the potential thing you were talking about.
He fell silent. Then?
Someone killed my mother and my father and my sister.
Yes. Someone did.
A man?
A man.
Which means you're asking the wrong question.
Silas raised an eyebrow.
How so?
Well, if I go outside in the world, the question isn't who will keep me safe from him.
No.
No. It's who will keep him safe from me.
Twigs scratched against the high windows, as if they needed to be let in. Silas flicked an imaginary speck of dust from his sleeve, with a fingernail as sharp as a blade.
We will need to find you a school.
No one noticed the boy. Not at first. No one even noticed that they hadn't noticed him. He sat halfway back in class. He didn't answer much, not unless he was directly asked a question, and even then his answers were short and forgettable, colourless. He faded in mind and in memory.
Do you think they're religious, his family?
Asked Mr. Kirby in the teacher's staff room. He was marking essays.
Whose family?
Owens, in 8B.
The tall, spotty lad?
I don't think so. Sort of medium height.
Mrs. McKinnon shrugged.
What about him?
Handwrites everything. Lovely handwriting. What they used to call copperplate.
And that makes him religious, because...
He says they don't have a computer.
And?
He doesn't have a phone.
I don't see why that makes him religious,
said Mrs. McKinnon, who had taken up crocheting when they had banned smoking in the staff room, and was sitting and crocheting a baby blanket, for no one in particular. Mr. Kirby shrugged.
He's a smart lad. There's just stuff he doesn't know. And in history, he'll throw in little made-up details, stuff not in the books.
What kind of stuff?
Mr. Kirby finished marking Bod's essay and put it down on the pile. Without something immediately in front of him, the whole matter seemed vague and unimportant.
Stuff,
he said, and forgot about it. Just as he forgot to enter Bod's name on the roll. Just as Bod's name was not to be found on the school databases. The boy was a model pupil, forgettable and easily forgotten, and he spent much of his spare time in the back of the English class, where there were shelves of old paperbacks, and in the school library, a large room filled with books and old armchairs, where he read stories as enthusiastically as some children ate. Even the other kids forgot about him. Not when he was sitting in front of them, they remembered him then. But when that Owens kid was out of sight, he was out of mind. They didn't think about him. They didn't need to. If someone asked all the kids in 8B to close their eyes and list the 25 boys and girls in the class, that Owens kid wouldn't have been on the list. His presence was almost ghostly. It was different if he was there, of course. Nick Farthing was 12, but he could pass, and did sometimes, for 16, a large boy, with a crooked smile and little imagination. He was practical in a basic sort of way, an efficient shoplifter, an occasional thug who did not care about being liked, as long as the other kids, all smaller, did what he said. Anyway, he had a friend. Her name was Maureen Quilling, but everyone called her Mo, and she was thin, and had pale skin, and pale yellow hair, watery blue eyes, and a sharp, inquisitive nose. Nick liked to shoplift, but Mo told him what to steal. Nick could hit and hurt and intimidate, but Mo pointed him at the people who needed to be intimidated. They were, as she told him sometimes, a perfect team. They were sitting in the corner of the library, spitting their take of the Year 7's pocket money. They had 8 or 9 of the 11-year-olds trained to hand over their pocket money every week.
The Sing Kid hasn't coughed up yet. You'll have to find him.
Yeah, he'll pay.
What was it he nicked? A CD?
Nick nodded.
Just point out the error of his ways,
said Mo, who wanted to sound like the hard cases from the television.
Easy. We're a good team.
Like Batman and Robin.
More like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
said somebody, who had been reading, unnoticed, in a window seat. And he got up and walked out of the room. Paul Singh was sitting on a windowsill by the changing rooms, his hands deep in his pockets, thinking dark thoughts. He took one hand out of his pocket, opened it, looked at the handful of pound coins, shook his head, closed his hand around the coins once more.
Is that what Nick and Mo are waiting for?
Somebody asked, and Paul jumped, scattering money all over the floor. The other boy helped him pick the coins up, handed them over. He was an older boy, and Paul thought he had seen him around before, but he could not be certain.
Are you with them? Nick and Mo?
The other boy shook his head.
Nope. I think that they are fairly repulsive.
He hesitated.
Actually, I came to give you a bit of advice.
Yeah?
Don't pay them.
Easy for you to say.
Because they aren't blackmailing me.
The boy looked at Paul, and Paul looked away, ashamed.
They hit you, or threatened you, until you shoplifted a CD for them. Then they told you that unless you handed over your pocket money to them, they'd tell on you. What did they do? Film you doing it?
Paul nodded.
Just say no. Don't do it.
They'll kill me. And they said...
Tell them that you think the police and school authorities could be a lot more interested in a couple of kids who are getting younger kids to steal for them, and then forcing them to hand over their pocket money, than they ever would be in one kid forced to steal a CD against his will. That if they touch you again, you'll make the call to the police. And that you've written it all up. And if anything happens to you, anything at all, if you get a black eye or anything... Your friends will automatically send it to the school authorities and the police.
But I can't!
Then you'll pay them your pocket money for the rest of your time in this school. And you'll stay scared of them.
Paul thought.
Why don't I just tell the police anyway?
Can if you like.
I'll try it your way first.
He smiled. It wasn't a big smile. But it was a smile, right enough. his first in 3 weeks. So Paul Singh explained to Nick Farthing just how and why he wouldn't be paying him any longer, and walked away, while Nick Farthing just stood and didn't say anything, clenching and unclenching his fists. And the next day, another 5 11-year-olds found Nick Farthing in the playground and told him they wanted their money back, all the pocket money they'd handed over in the previous month, or they'd be going to the police. And now Nick Farthing was an extremely unhappy young man.
It was him. He started it. If it wasn't for him, they'd never have thought of it on their own. He's the one we have to teach a lesson. Then they'll all behave.
Who?
The one who's always reading. The one from the library. Bob Owens. Him.
Nick nodded slowly.
Which one is he?
I'll point him out to you.
Bod was used to being ignored, to existing in the shadows. When glances naturally slip from you, you become very aware of eyes upon you, of glances in your direction, of attention. And if you barely exist in people's minds as another living person, then being pointed to, being followed around, these things draw attention to themselves. They followed him out of the school and up the road, past the corner newsagent and across the railway bridge. He took his time, making certain that the two who were following him, a burly boy and a fair, sharp-faced girl, did not lose him. Then he walked into the tiny churchyard at the end of the road, a miniature graveyard behind the local church, and he waited beside the tomb of Roderick Person and his wife Amabella, and also his second wife, Portunia. They sleep to wake again.
You're that kid, Bob Owens. Well, you're in really big trouble, Bob Owens.
It's Bod, actually.
And he looked at them.
With a D. And you're Jekyll and Hyde.
It was you. You got to the seventh formers.
So we're going to teach you a lesson,
said Nick Farthing. And he smiled, without humour.
I quite like lessons. If you paid more attention to yours, you wouldn't have to blackmail younger kids for pocket money.
Nick's brow crinkled.
You're dead, Owens.
Bod shook his head, and he gestured around him.
I'm not actually. They are.
Who are?
The people in this place. Look, I brought you here to give you a choice.
You didn't bring us here.
You're here. I wanted you here. I came here. You followed me. Same thing.
Mo looked around nervously.
You've got friends here.
You're missing the point, I'm afraid. You two need to stop this. Stop behaving like other people don't matter. Stop hurting people.
Mo grinned a sharp grin.
For heaven's sake! Hit him!
I gave you a chance.
Nick swung a vicious fist at Bod. He was no longer there. And Nick's fist slammed into the side of the gravestone.
Where did he go?
Nick was swearing and shaking his hand. She looked around the shadowy cemetery, puzzled.
He was here. You know he was.
Nick had little imagination. And he was not about to start thinking now.
Maybe he ran away.
He didn't run. He just wasn't there anymore.
Mo had an imagination. The ideas were hers. It was twilight in a spooky churchyard, and the hairs on the back of her neck were prickling.
Something is really, really wrong.
Then she said, in a higher-pitched, panicky voice,
we have to get out of here!
I'm going to find that kid. I'm going to beat the stuffing out of him.
Mo felt something unsettled in the pit of her stomach. The shadows seemed to move around them.
Nick, I'm scared.
Fear is contagious. You can catch it. Sometimes all it takes is for someone to say that they're scared, for the fear to become real. Mo was terrified, and now Nick was too. Nick didn't say anything, he just ran, and Mo ran close on his heels. The streetlights were coming on as they ran back towards the world, turning the twilight into night, making the shadows into dark places in which anything could be happening. They ran until they reached Nick's house, and they went inside and turned on all the lights, and Mo called her mother and demanded, half crying, to be picked up and driven the short distance to her own house because she wasn't walking home that night. Bod had watched them run with satisfaction.
"That was good, dear,"
said someone behind him, a tall woman in white.
"A nice fade first, then the fear."
"Thank you. I hadn't even tried the fear out on living people. I mean, I knew the theory, but, well."
"It worked a treat. I'm Amabella Person."
"Bod. Nobody Owens."
"The live boy? From the big graveyard on the hill? Really?"
Bod hadn't realized that anyone knew who he was beyond his own graveyard. Amabella was knocking on the side of the tomb.
"Roddy! Petunia! Come and see who's here!"
There were three of them there then, and Amabella was introducing Bod, and he was shaking hands and saying,
"Charmed, I'm sure."
Because he could greet people politely over 900 years of changing manners.
"Master Owens here was frightening some children who doubtless deserved it."
"Good show. Bounders guilty of reprehensible behaviour, eh?"
"They were bullies. Making kids hand over their pocket money. Stuff like that."
"A frightening is certainly a good beginning,"
said Petunia Person, who was a stout woman, much older than Amabella.
"And what have you planned if it does not work?"
"I hadn't really thought."
"I should suggest that dreamwalking might be the most efficient remedy. You can dreamwalk, can you not?"
"I'm not sure. Mr. Pennyworth showed me how, but I haven't really... Well, there's things I only really know in theory, and..."
"Dreamwalking is all very well, but might I suggest a good visitation? That's the only language that these people understand." "Oh, a visitation? Petunia, my dear, I don't really think so." "No, you don't. Luckily one of us thinks."
"I have to be getting home. They'll be worrying about me."
"Of course."
"Lovely to meet you. A very good evening to you, young man."
Amabella Person and Petunia Person glared at each other.
"If you'll forgive me asking, but your guardian, he is well?"
"Silas? Yes, he's fine."
"Give him our regards. I'm afraid a small churchyard like this, well, we're never going to meet an actual member of the Honor Guard. Still, it's good to know that they're there."
"Good night. I'll tell him,"
said Bod, who had no idea what the man was talking about, but filed it away for later. He picked up his bag of school books and he walked home, taking comfort in the shadows. Going to school with the living did not excuse Bod from his lessons with the dead. The nights were long, and sometimes Bod would apologize and crawl to bed exhausted before midnight. Mostly, he just kept going. Mr. Pennyworth had little to complain of these days. Bod studied hard and asked questions. Tonight, Bod asked about hauntings, getting more and more specific, which exasperated Mr. Pennyworth, who had never gone in for that sort of thing himself.
"How exactly do I make a cold spot in the air? I think I got fear down, but how do I take it all the way up to terror?"
Mr. Pennyworth sighed and humped and did his best to explain, and it was gone 4 in the morning before they were done. Bod was tired at school the next day. The first class was history, a subject Bod mostly enjoyed, although he often had to resist the urge to say that It hadn't happened like that. Not according to people who had been there anyway. But this morning Bod was fighting to stay awake. He was doing all he could to concentrate on the lesson, so he was not paying attention to much else going on around him. He was thinking about King Charles I, and about his parents,